You're listening to Green Mountain Medicine, an original podcast series by ACP Vermont for all things internal medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And we're your hosts.
This series aims to unpack the complexity of medicine in a nuanced and evidence-based way. We invite you to relax, grab some coffee, maybe some tea, maybe you're just a water person, and engage with us as we discuss the topics that impact our fields and characterize our practice.
Today, we have Dr. Garth Garrison as our special guest on the podcast. Dr. Garrison, could you tell the listeners a little bit about your role at the hospital?
Sure. So my name is Garth Garrison. I'm an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Pulmonary Critical Care Medicine here at the UVM Medical Center and the Larner College of Medicine. I've been here for 13 years now at this point. I have several roles. Clinically, I staff the lung nodule clinic and the lung cancer multidisciplinary clinic and perform some bronchoscopic biopsies and see patients with suspected lung cancer. And then I'm our pulmonary critical care fellowship director. I'm the director of the fourth year acting internship in internal medicine for the medical school. Also teach the bulk of the pulmonary section for the second year medical students. And so have a lot of different teaching roles and I'm involved in some of our national organizations, sort of the like an education committee for American Thoracic Society and others. So love doing education, love doing teaching.
That's awesome. Thanks so much for sharing with us about your many roles. Katie and I know Dr. Garrison from his teaching of pulmonology in our cardio, respiratory, and renal course, but it's always really cool to hear what physicians do outside of the classroom setting as well.
Yeah, I don't know how you do all that. That was the whole paragraph of things. With your busy, busy schedule, what would you say a day in your life is like when you are not teaching?
So when I'm not teaching, because of all of the roles that I have a decent amount of time that is uncommitted. Mostly when I'm not teaching, I have clinic and I have between 2 and 3 half days of clinic, sometimes 4. And then I'll do the time when I'm not in clinic will be time where working on education things, doing some teaching. I teach every week for the our pulmonary fellows. I do an hour of teaching every week for them. I do between 2 and 3 hours a week. Generally, I alternate with my co-director for the acting internship, do procedures on Fridays, and then several times a year I'll be on like the inpatient consult service for a week, and then very occasionally in the intensive care unit.
Very exciting. A lot of different hats that you must wear. Which role would you say you look the most forward to doing each day?
Which role? Well, I think the real advantage of having a mix of things is that there's a lot of variety in what days are like. And so I can spend a lot of time working on something for a while, and then I can go do something else for a while. It's really fun to have CRR come up and have to relearn a bunch of things and figure out how to teach them. And that's an interesting challenge. So then for part of the year, we're working on that. And then, you know, it might be, you know, it's fellowship interview season. And so now I've sort of changed gears a little bit and spending some time on fellowship interviews. And then there's a huge amount of variability. I mean, I just really like engaging with people and doing teaching. I also really, really like taking care of patients. And so that's just one of the advantages of being, for me, at the Academic Medical Center is that I can just do so many different things and teach second year med students and fourth year medical students. And sometimes we do lectures for third year medical students and doing some things for residents and then doing the fellow teaching and just being involved in all the different levels of learner is great. But underneath it, I think, you know, the reason I went into medicine was to interact with people who have medical problems. And so I do find my time in clinic to be really, really valuable. You know, I have a lot of really great people that I get to meet in clinic and it's great to see some of the people over and over again, and it's good to see some of the people that you've helped, and so I really actually look forward to clinic. I don't always look forward to all the notes from clinic, but the actually interacting with patients is really awesome.
That's so great. Kind of building off of that more clinical lens, we were wondering what your opinions are of some of the most important things for primary care to know about pulmonology.
So I think there's are certainly some conditions where there's a lot of overlap, asthma and COPD, and we have a role where we can provide, I think, a lot of help in terms of clarifying people's diagnoses and getting people on the right management. I think it's great to be in a situation where we can kind of share some of these patients who have really common conditions, where we ensure they've got the right diagnosis, and then they go and come back when things are worse. It's kind of surprising how often people might be assumed to have a diagnosis when we can't really support it. So COPD might be an example, and someone who's short of breath, history of smoking, and is assumed to have COPD, and they might not, you know, they might have something else. And so I think that's one spot where we can be kind of helpful. We see a lot of other common things like lung nodules that are really, really common, can really cause a lot of concern for people. It's really scary to get a CT and see that you've got a lung nodule and someone's worried about cancer. And so we provide some comfort and say, look, we're not concerned about this. And if we are concerned, to help expedite some of the evaluation. Also in our clinic, you know, we have really great support from respiratory therapists who can help with making sure that they're doing the right inhaler technique for some people who aren't seeing good control of their symptoms. So they have asthma, but maybe they just never got showed how to use their inhaler. So when people come in, we can have them work with our respiratory therapists and MAs. We've got a great team to help manage supplies like oxygen, devices to help break up mucus, like physiotherapy vests and stuff. So we really see a lot, and we have a lot of people in clinic who can really, really help us. We have an awesome clinical pharmacist that we've had now for a couple of years who is really helpful for us as we're expanding the kinds of therapies that we can offer for some conditions, particularly asthma, where there's a lot of new medications that are available and require some specialty pharmacy assistance.
I mean, it makes sense that teamwork is so important in any medical practice, but especially in pulmonology. And I know you mentioned about respiratory therapist kind of helping inhaler technique with patients. I think that's so important. And obviously physicians are really busy doing a million things. So it's nice to have somebody to be able to sit down with patients, I'm sure, and walk them through that whole process. That's really great to hear.
Yeah. And they really know because they work with them a lot. And there's so many different inhalers. A kind of company has their own device that's slightly different and might have some little quirks with it. And they've seen a lot of these, and they know the little tips and tricks that might help people to use their medication more effectively.
Absolutely.
We saw how the pandemic revolutionized many different specialties in medicine. So we were just wondering, how did the COVID-19 pandemic affect the pulmonology specialty and specifically critical care?
So certainly during the pandemic, there were a lot of changes for us. We were frontline in the ICU taking care of some very sick people. We were very, very fortunate in Vermont that our experience with COVID was very different than in some other cities where there was a lot more severe illness in the ICU. But we did have some. There's been a lot of changes from the pandemic. People have had different priorities. We've had a lot of changes in staffing. We have had people retire, and there's been a lot more traveling nurses, and they're great. It's great to have that resource. There were some things that didn't go well through the pandemic, like people missing their screening CTs, and you know, there's been a catch up on that as people are getting back in and getting their medical care back. I think overall people are a lot more in the pulmonology side. I think a lot of the people that we see are a lot more sort of cognizant about the impact of viral infections on their health. It was pretty amazing actually for us in clinic. There's a lot of people who might have COPD or asthma who went 2 years without having a viral infection because they were masked and isolated. And for some people that was a real problem because maybe they have grandkids. And so that limitation in interaction was a real problem. But for some people, they felt great. They didn't get sick for 2 years. And so they've been a lot more aware of trying to stay healthy, and people much more likely to wear masks when they're out. A lot of people have been really aggressive about trying to get vaccinated and just trying to limit the number of times that they're getting sick, because you can do a lot with inhalers and things to help people's symptoms, but you know, not getting sick if you've got some of these conditions is really, really important. So we also have seen a lot of people who've had consequences of long COVID symptoms, and there are a lot of people that are recognizing that they have kind of long-lasting symptoms from it. And that population is kind of slowly growing over time.
Yeah, that was also what I was going to ask of just the patient population and how frequent you're seeing long COVID syndrome, or even how do you know the difference between having long COVID bursts worsening COPD and things like that. So you answered it though.
Kind of touching more on immunizations, I'm hearing that it's really important for people to get vaccinated, especially people with certain pulmonary conditions. So how would you go about counseling patients on the importance of vaccinations or any new healthcare measures? I'm thinking particularly the RSV vaccine, which is a newer intervention for older adults. How would you talk to a patient about something like this?
You know, I like to sit down and just really talk with people about what their values are and what their risks are. There's a lot of variability in people's willingness to take things that are new. Some people are really in favor of it. Some people are not. There's certainly been a lot more vaccinations that people have had as adults recently than they're used to in the past. And so there's certainly been a lot more kind of suspicion, I think, about some of the new vaccines. For the RSV vaccine, I think the people that we're really trying to talk to more about it are people who do have those kind of like airway diseases, who, you know, might be at risk for having exacerbations from the RSV if they're, particularly if they're over 65, and talking about their risks of exacerbation and then experiences with people getting the vaccine. So I try not to be too pushy about, you know, which of the vaccines to do, because I think the more that you are going to push something, the oftentimes the less effective it is. And it's, you know, and it's more useful just to say, you know, hey, what do you think about this? You know, this is new. It might be helpful, especially because you've got asthma and that's a group of people that we might be particularly concerned about. You know, have you thought about it? What have you heard about it? Do you know anyone that's had it? And then get their thoughts about it. And then we can talk about it. And this comes up even for vaccines that have been around for a long time, though, even like influenza. So there's a lot of people that have had experience with an influenza vaccine in the past and they haven't ever had severe influenza. And so they come and they say, I don't want to get vaccinated for influenza. And so it's nice just to sit down and see like, well, why not? Okay, well, just because you had a bad reaction before, you know, if it was an allergic reaction or something, we'd have a different, but a lot of people have kind of like a flu-like reaction afterwards. You know, that may not happen now. And you might be at a higher risk now for having complications. And so particularly if we're starting to see more influenza, it might make more sense to have you vaccinated. So I like to just talk with people and try and be down to earth and see why they're thinking and what they're thinking and see if we can come to a joint decision on what makes sense for them.
Right. Yeah. I think it's really important to kind of walk the line between figuring out people's reasoning behind what they're doing or how they're feeling, while also making sure not to judge patients or make them feel kind of ostracized for their viewpoints. So those are great points.
Dr. Garrison, as a critical care pulmonologist, how do you combat the risks of ventilator-associated pneumonia with the necessity of using a ventilator to manage those critical patients?
Great question. And so no matter what, being on a ventilator, you know, does carry some risk. So there's risks of pneumonia and respiratory muscle weakness, and you can get skeletal muscle weakness because of disuse. And so being on a ventilator is not healthy. And we like to only use it when it's required to maintain someone's life. We do have some other tools in the ICU. We have non-invasive ventilation and we've got high flow nasal cannula that have been really great in terms of allowing us to really defer the number of people getting on the ventilator. So that's really the first step in reducing the ventilator associated pneumonia, is to only use it when you really, really have to. There are some measures that they take when people are on ventilators. So keeping the head of the bed elevated is one where, you know, we try and reduce the risk of aspiration and things that might contribute to ventilator associated pneumonia. And then really getting them off of the ventilator as quickly as possible is really important. And so we've been pretty aggressive at trying to get people screened every day. So get their sedation off and get them screened every day to see if we can pull the endotracheal tube out. In the past, things used to happen kind of on a 24-hour schedule where, you know, they would get checked once a day and then get checked out again on rounds the next day. And anymore, it's sort of like, you know, anytime during the day, the person might get on a breathing trial to see if they can get the breathing tube pulled. We have a team on at night that can help get them off the ventilator. We really like to use things for as short of a time as possible. And when people are on the ventilator, in terms of some of the settings, you know, we know that high pressures on the ventilator and high volumes can injure the lungs. And if you've got a bad pneumonia, or you've got sepsis, or you've aspirated, you might have a risk of developing ARDS, which can be really severe. And, you know, many people have bad outcomes when they develop ARDS. And so we do like to, just as a default, use generally on the lower side of the ventilator pressures and volumes, just to help stay away from injurious positive pressure.
When a patient is on the ventilator, is there more of a risk of extubating too soon and then having to re-intubate with pneumonia, or is it the prolonged time that's more of the concern?
Yeah, that's a good question. You never like to have someone that's unstable. And so you hate to extubate someone and then have to re-intubate them, because there's going to be some risk when they have to be re-intubated. Overall, we're probably better off having some amount of people that need to be re-intubated, 5 or 10% that need to be re-intubated in 24 hours, because that means we're aggressively trying to get people off the ventilator. And the quicker we get people off the ventilator, the better it is for everyone. So we probably do more good by trying to be aggressive at taking people off.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Kind of switching gears here a little bit, Katie and I were wondering about the process of getting a lung transplant.
So lung transplants are really complicated decisions. So there's a list of criteria, and the criteria vary based on what your diagnosis is. And they've made some adjustments to that over time. So if you think of like, what's the most common lung disease that might cause someone to need a transplant? Well, in the past, COPD was the most common diagnosis. But the good thing with COPD is that if people get on appropriate therapy and are able to stop smoking, the COPD progression is slow enough that in a lot of people, it doesn't make sense to do a transplant. There have been some adjustments, and now idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis and cystic fibrosis are ones that are more likely to get transplanted because they have more of a risk of progressing towards severe respiratory failure without the transplant. So for one, the process of getting the transplant is having a diagnosis and then meeting some of the referral criteria, which the people who would be transplant candidates are generally under 60 or 65 years old. There's no hard cutoff for age. I believe now many places sort of evaluate people on a case-by-case basis, but that's kind of like a general guide for age. People need, if they do smoke, they need to have stopped smoking and gone through pulmonary rehabilitation so we can know that we've kind of maximized all of the things we can do to help their lungs, you know, compliance with good medical therapy and all of that. And if we've done all of that and the person looks like they're progressing towards a transplant, then we'll refer them to a transplant program. It'll depend on where they're coming from. So if they're coming from New York, we might be sending them to New York City for a transplant evaluation. If they're in Vermont, then we'll refer them to one of the Boston programs. Transplant evaluation for lung transplant is fairly extensive. A lot of blood work that gets done, and they do cancer screening, and they do some cardiac evaluation to make sure people can get through the surgery. There's a lot of counseling that happens. They try and make sure that the people have the support to be able to go through the transplant. And then they'll make a decision there whether or not to list the person. And then, once the person is listed, we try and support them up here as best we can. And when they get called down, they have to hurry down to Boston, get into the hospital and get the transplant. And then we'll often follow them concurrently up here also. Lung transplants, it has probably lagged behind some of the other transplants in terms of how well the outcomes are with it. Things are getting better for sure over time. And there were in the last decade, some improvements for sure in terms of the survival with lung transplant. But a lung transplant involves a very, very large surgery. You're faced with a challenging situation of needing to be on immune suppression, but having an organ that's constantly exposed to the environment and walking that balance of like accepting infections and or having rejection. And so a lot of people who have lung transplants will face chronic rejection. And so that's one of the reasons why there's just so much counseling and workup ahead of time to make sure that it's, you know, the right person and the person is really going to kind of benefit from having it done.
You said that cystic fibrosis is one of the most common diagnoses that might go on to require a lung transplant. Have you, or do you know of any literature that has investigated or explored like Trikafta, or like how Trikafta and the incidence of cystic fibrosis and treatment of it, has it affected the transplant necessity in the condition?
It will definitely reduce the transplant need. A lot of new cystic fibrosis treatments with many people on Trikafta have been kind of like a game changer for people with cystic fibrosis. A lot fewer exacerbations, improvements in weight, improvements in quality of life. And I think there's a lot of expectation that the people who are able to be on Trikafta, and as they're looking at it, you know, starting it earlier and earlier, you know, the longer that they're on it, the less likely it is that they're going to develop severe lung disease. If they can develop less severe lung disease, hopefully they have less infections and less lung damage, and hopefully we'll need less transplants. So I would imagine in the future that we will just people who are able to be on one of those agents, you know, they may be able to avoid having the need for transplant in the future.
That's great to hear. And also, it's very interesting to hear about sending folks down to Boston. And I imagine kind of like the rush of if they end up having, you know, get approved for transplant and actually get a transplant in that matches having to rush down to Boston. Boy, that must be quite stressful for patients and their families.
Yeah, especially because you just have no idea when it's going to happen. And oftentimes, you know, for lung transplant, people really need to be ill enough to have it be worthwhile. So we want to be able to have some kind of improvement from the transplant, but they can't be sick enough that they still have to be functional. So they still have to be able to walk and have sort of like a mild or moderate amount of functional capacity to be able to tolerate the surgery. So they need to be on this balance. So a lot of times they're at home, but they're still kind of sick and can't do all the things that they would like to do. But the minute that they get called, they have to, you know, so they kind of have to be ready to go all the time. So it is very stressful for people who are kind of listed because they're just like waiting, they're not feeling great. And then it's like today, they can give you a general idea if they think that something's going to come up. But, you know, you just don't know until they call you for sure.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. That was very educational.
Dr. Garrison, we have seen how the incidence of vaping has increased throughout the past couple years tremendously. Would you say that vaping and smoking both have synonymous damage to the lungs from the patients that you've evaluated?
So I would say that most of the damage from the cigarette smoking comes from the burned biomass. So all the particulates that people are inhaling, that's really where a lot of the carcinogens are, and the things that induce some of the lung damage are found in the tars and stuff that people are exposed to. That's not in the vape products. And so the less tar is good. What we don't know about vaping is we just don't know about long-term consequences of vaping. So it's really hard to say that it's safer without really knowing that data that, you know, that smoke, and as people get more used to it, if they smoke more, what kinds of damage might you be experiencing? We do know that the regulation of it is a little bit different, and it's easier to have things that are in the products that may not be safe. And you might end up with effects from vaping that aren't necessarily lung related. So some of the flavorings and things that get heated up and inhaled might cause, you know, protein changes that cause effects in other organs. So we don't really know. The nicotine addiction is the same, and vaping does allow for people to have potentially like high amounts of nicotine exposure. It's much easier to have high doses of nicotine exposure with vaping rather than cigarettes. Cigarettes are fairly standard in how much nicotine they have. Vaping, people can get concentrated solutions and even insert other cartridges in that may have more, and so addiction may be worse if people are vaping long term. So I think, you know, our clinic has been of the mind of saying smoking isn't healthy. Vaping is still contributing to nicotine addiction, which may not be good in the long term. We don't know the long term consequences of vaping, and there's reason to think that there may still be harm with vaping. And so we would really prefer that people do neither one in terms of respiratory health. Prior to COVID, there was a whole outbreak of something called e-cigarette and vaping acute lung injury, EVALI. And seems like probably the result of some things being added to the e-cigarette or the vape solution. So vitamin E oil that was added and caused some people to have kind of really severe lung disease from that. And so, you know, just as an example of how easy it is. And this was a widespread problem that they saw in multiple states and all over the U.S. So, you know, it's something that's certainly can present problems into the future. So I think for long-term health, it's best, I think, to have less exposure to nicotine and not have the nicotine addiction. And that's kind of the way that we can suggest for people to be healthiest.
Yeah, you made some really great points that I didn't even think about, how with all the additives that are and chemicals that are in these products, how they could be affecting other organs. So thank you for sharing that. And also, I think when people hear vitamin E oil, they may think, oh, it's good for your skin, but maybe not good for your lungs. So yeah, those are really good points.
So speaking a bit more about chemicals, we've all seen the incidence of environmental disasters increasing on the news, including wildfires as close as the Quebec area. How do you imagine, Dr. Garrison, this impacting your patient's health in the future or currently?
Well, we certainly know that the particulates from wildfire smoke, especially the really small particulates, the 2.5 micron particulates, can contribute to worsening lung health. And we know that from wildfires, but also from pollution from automobiles or industrial pollution. So these high particulate levels can cause worsening asthma, can contribute to development of COPD, can lead to lower peak lung size. And so there's all kinds of problems with being exposed to these sort of small organic particles, just like kind of smoking cigarettes. You know, when you're exposed to organic material that's burned in and you inhale it, there's certainly a chance for lung problems. If temperatures were to rise and areas become drier and we have more wildfires or large wildfires, people will be affected by that. The number of wildfires has been a little bit variable and a little bit random in terms of where the peak of the impact is. But, you know, if we do see more wildfires, that's a concern. There's also a concern with climate change and severe weather. And so people can have worsening asthma control around the time of large rainstorms. We call it thunderclap asthma. And so people may report if there are more frequent severe storms that may lead to worse asthma control in a lot of people.
Yeah, you make a great point there. And I also wonder, you know, in the future with climate change, I imagine that accessibility to medical care, even to be able to go to the pharmacy to pick up your medications, might become difficult. For example, with flooding, I also wonder how that might impact patients in the future who might really rely on medical care and medications as well.
Yeah. And think of how many people are getting mail order prescriptions who are used to getting that. And so if there's situations where the mail can't be delivered, it may be hard for them to get their medication. So and certainly there was in Vermont problems with people having access to their pharmacy for a period of time.
Switching gears just a little bit, working in the ICU where there's high acuity and intense cases daily, how would you say you handle the day-to-day of death with patients, and how do you convey bad news to the family or support system that's there?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's a lot of stress, and it takes a while to get used to having a percentage of their patients not do well and potentially die. You know, for me personally, dealing with bad news always starts with having open and honest conversations with families and as early as possible. So, you know, meeting and letting everybody know where things stand and how things might go, being honest about what we know and don't know, and trying to build that trust so that they, you know, trust you that you're making the right decisions, but then also trust what you're saying about their loved one and what the condition is. And then if you're, you know, if we're kind of going through things honestly and openly, I think if things don't go according to plan, the family is at least understanding why that might be the case and is more accepting of how things have gone down. When things are more sudden, it can be a harder conversation with people if they weren't expecting for bad things to happen. But, you know, the bottom line is sometimes things don't go the way we would like in the ICU, and you have to just sit down and talk with the families. I think it's always nice if you've got challenging cases to take a few minutes with your team and go and debrief a little bit. Sometimes if there's been a really long resuscitation or something, that the nurses or the trainees, the fellows and residents, you know, they just may need some time to kind of to talk and decompress and, you know, share their thoughts about things and kind of reflect. I think that can be really valuable too.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with just giving the patients and their families the time, even though that you have so many other patients and really acute cases, just like taking that extra time. So when we eventually do rotations, hopefully we'll incorporate that.
Absolutely. Our final question for today is, what area of pulmonology do you feel needs more research funding?
What needs more research funding? I think all of it. Be selfish and say all of it. Well, I think to be honest, things have been improving over time. We have, I think, for a long time, lung cancer, despite lung cancer being the leading cause of cancer related death in the United States and the world, was receiving a proportionately small amount of research funding. And so, compared to some other cancers, I think that's certainly one area that I think there's still room to improve. But we have started to see some new treatments and some new approaches. There was a really large lung cancer screening trial that the government funded a number of years ago to support, you know, screening for lung cancer, which is new and 2015, there hadn't really ever been a proven way to screen people for lung cancer before. So I think that that's been improving. COPD, I think there's certainly room to improve our care for patients with COPD, especially given how common it is and how debilitating it is. And we have four kinds of inhalers that we use for people with COPD, and we've had kind of the same four class of inhalers for a long time. And so different strategies to approach people with COPD are needed. There's been some push to use some medications that might also work in asthma. So some of the anti-IL-4 agents may work for COPD also. And so, but just thinking about new ways to approach those people is great. Looking at other ways where we can do interventions to help people with COPD is an area that's kind of growing right now. So, you know, are there things that are short of large surgeries that we can do to help? And, you know, long-term, are there ways that we can actually help lungs to regenerate? So could there be, you know, more investment in kind of the stem cells and finding ways to help areas of the lung heal and potentially regenerate would be really neat things to see. So everything in pulmonary is interesting and deserving of lots of attention, but I would sort of think about those. Idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis is an area where I think has gotten a lot of more interest, but our number of treatments available for idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis is very small. So there's essentially two treatments that are available that are very expensive. This is a condition that can be fatal for a lot of people. And so we definitely have a need for more strategies to help with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. So lots of interesting areas. And, you know, I think we've got some research going on here in many of those areas. If you're interested in looking at summer research projects.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing with us. And thank you for being on the podcast today. It was such a pleasure to have you.
Well, thanks for having me. It was fun.
All right, folks. If you're still here, thanks for sticking with us. That's it for today on Green Mountain Medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our discussion, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @ACP_Vermont for more podcast updates, or subscribe to us on YouTube at Green Mountain Medicine.